Welcome to Smart Talk. I'm Scott Lamar. More than 70 years after World War II, it's unusual to find a story that hasn't been told. But best-selling author Liza Mundy has done that with her latest book, Code Girls, The Untold Story of the American Women Codebreakers of World War II. There are several reasons the story of how thousands of mostly young American women broke secret codes from the Japanese and German military during the war, but one of the most significant is they were sworn to secrecy, and many were even hesitant to talk about what they did today. Liza Mundy recently appeared at Midtown Scholar Bookstore during their Harrisburg Book Fest, where I spoke with her about Code Girls. Liza Mundy, welcome to Harrisburg.
Oh, thank you for having me.
The title of the book, Code Girls, The Untold Story of the American Women Codebreakers of World War II. Why has it been an untold story?
For several reasons. This was a group of over 10,000 women who came to Washington to do this work. When they arrived, they were told that if they spoke to anyone about the work they were doing, they would be shot because it was wartime, and to divulge classified information would be an act of treason, and the penalty for treason was death. And they took that very, very seriously. And then after the war, they were told, thanks very much for your service. Don't ever tell anybody what you did. And they also took that very, very seriously. And so part of it was the women's staunch adherence to the vow of secrecy. And then when it became declassified in the 1980s, nobody tracked the women down and told them that it was finally okay to talk. And meanwhile, historians who began writing about World War II codebreaking in the 70s and 80s really neglected to tell the women's story. They really overlooked it. When the women came to Washington, they were told, if anybody asks what you do in these top secret barbed wire compounds, tell them that you're secretaries. Tell them that the work you're doing is trivial and unimportant. Tell them that you emptied waste baskets and sharpened pencils. So that's what they told them. And because they were women, people believed that the work they were doing had to be trivial. And the mistake that historians made even 50 years later was also assuming that the work they did was trivial. And it wasn't. It was of the utmost importance.
And the men who worked with the code-breaking women, men in the military as well, knew and had a lot of respect for what they did. Plus, they also were fairly well paid for that time, right?
Right. Many of the women, including my central character, who was from Lynchburg, Virginia, had been school teachers. So these were school teachers who were sinking ships. And generally before the war, as school teachers, they made about $900 a year. That's how much my central character made teaching high school. And working for the U.S. government, they could make $1,600 a year, or maybe get a raise to $1,700 or $1,800. But, you know, some of them were at $2,000 by the end of the war. So, yeah, they got paid better.
You know, one of the most fascinating part, we were just talking about this, but one of the most fascinating parts of the book, you talked about they were sworn to secrecy. But even 70 years later, many of the characters in the book, call them characters, the women codebreakers, were still a little reluctant to talk about it, weren't they?
Yes, in many cases they were. Again, my central character, Dot Braden, who is still alive at 98, went 4 years ago when I was trying to talk her into talking to me. I was there with her son, who her beloved eldest son, who, you know, who she dotes upon and trusts. And even with him in the room, it took us half an hour to coax it out of her. And finally, you know, she wanted to talk about it. You know, she wanted legitimately to get credit for what she did, but she wasn't sure. And so after about a half an hour, she said, well, you know, what are they going to do at this point? Put me in prison? And I said, well, at your age, it would probably be a nice prison. And she has a very good sense of humor, so she thought that was funny. And yeah.
Well, let's go back before the United States was even involved in World War II officially. Now, we were supplying a lot of materials to Great Britain and in the European countries, but the military started, but there was recruitment of many women, as you mentioned, teachers and some others as well. But many of them were being recruited even before the war began. Why?
Well, because the federal government was a relative equal opportunity employer. So women who were college educated, who wanted a career other than teaching school, would sometimes take the civil service exam and would just apply for federal service. And at that time, before the war, the Army and the Navy both had very small code-breaking bureaus. They were working on Japanese code systems, German code systems, Italian, you know, they were starting to look at the fascist governments of Europe, but very small, non-prestigious bureaus. And in particular, the Army's bureau had was headed by a man named William Friedman, who was married to a female codebreaker. So he had a lot of respect for women and their intellects. And he would scour the civil service roles for high scores in math and languages and recruit women into those codebreaking operations. So the Army's operation in particular had a number of women working for it. One of them, Genevieve Grochin, made a very significant break in 1940 before we were in the war, breaking a code system that Japanese diplomats in Europe were using to communicate with Tokyo. It was a system called Purple. And she had the central insight that would enable us to read the diplomats' communications all during World War II. And then the Navy had a woman named Agnes Driscoll, who had actually enlisted during World War I when there was a brief period women could enlist. And then she stayed on as a civilian. And she spent the 1930s diagnosing how the Japanese Navy encoded and then enciphered its fleet code, really figuring that system out. And that played a big role in our victory in the Battle of Midway.
And we're going to talk about all those things, but I want to take a step back, even since you mentioned World War I and Agnes, that one of the things that they did find out was that Germany had offered Mexico, Texas, Arizona, and New Mexico if Mexico would invade the United States.
Right. That was the famous Zimmerman telegram. And because we didn't have much code-breaking ability prior to World War I, it was the British who broke that particular telegram. And we then had to really get up to speed in our code-breaking abilities, because England and Europe had a long, centuries-old tradition of reading each other's mail, as they put it. But we were sort of, you know, babes in the wood when it came to that kind of intelligence work. So we had to play catch up.
So over the ensuing years, we get up to 1939, 1940. As we said, the United States was starting to recruit some code breakers. What kind of women were they looking for?
So they were looking for college-educated women, for the most part. And up until the war, if you were a college-educated woman in the United States, the only job you could reliably expect upon graduation was teaching school, which is great if you want to be a school teacher, but not if you want to go into a different field. So they wanted women who had good liberal arts education, languages, Latin, French, you know, an understanding of how language works and how, you know, linguistic patterns, an understanding of that. But also there's a fair amount of math involved. So they were looking for women who had had the benefit of good liberal arts education, who could keep their mouth shut. And they were also looking for undergraduates who had what we would call today grit, who had resilience, the ability to tolerate failure, to keep coming back and back at a problem. And so the Navy asked math and astronomy professors at the Seven Sisters Colleges, as well as Goucher, Connecticut College, Wheaton College, to identify young women who had these characteristics. And they were quietly called in and asked two questions: do you like crossword puzzles, and are you engaged to be married? And if they answered yes to the first and no to the second, they would be invited to take a secret naval correspondence course in code breaking. And a lot of them lied. A lot of them were engaged, but whatever they were being invited to do sounded pretty interesting. So,
but in the book, you also mentioned there were a couple other characteristics they were looking for: non-Jewish,
yeah,
and attractive. Why?
Oh, you know, I don't know if they were specifically looking for attractive, but they did make comments on the women's photos that they had to submit with their application. So that was maybe more of an after-the-fact sort of thing. Although the way that the Army recruited all these school teachers, speaking of attractiveness, was to send its handsomest young officers, its handsomest young Army officers, to lurk in post offices and hotels with the thinking that they could lure these young school teachers to Washington, that the women would be thinking they could make a marriage to a man who looked like the Army officer. So they were a bit obsessed with marriage, I'd say, the recruiters.
Non-Jewish, I think.
Yes.
Today we know why, but what about then?
Right. So before the war, the Navy was very discriminatory, you know, throughout the war, really, in who they would recruit. And when the waves admitted African-American women, the Navy did not accept the African-American waves. The Army would have an African-American code-breaking unit. But to get back to the non-Jewish, particularly before the war, they were very stuffy about Jewish or anybody from a country with family origins in a country that was now occupied. But because before we got into the war, they were afraid that if you recruited people from these countries or who were Jewish, that they would be inclined to get us into the war somehow, as though they would have the ability to do that. But
So we've talked about the run-up to the war. Everything changed December 7th, 1941. But, you know, one of the questions that there's always been these conspiracy theories about Pearl Harbor and why we didn't know about Pearl Harbor ahead of time. With the codebreakers, who were very good, very successful, why didn't we know about Pearl Harbor?
So what had happened was that, so Agnes Driscoll spent the 1930s diagnosing how the Japanese naval fleet code worked. We understood that it was what they could call an enciphered code system, and I can explain what that is if you want. But so we understood how it worked, but they had code books that were like dictionaries of the words, and those code books changed every so often, as well as cipher books of numbers that would be added to the code groups. And as a secure practice, they would change those books periodically. And so right before Pearl Harbor, they changed the code books. So we had been reading the code system, and suddenly we couldn't anymore. We had to rebuild an understanding of what the code groups stood for. So the code system had gone dark to us temporarily. And we would get it back by the Battle of Midway, which was 7 months after Pearl Harbor. We have rebuilt the code books, but it had gone dark in that period.
But there was no hint of any Japanese plans to attack an American military installation?
Well, we knew that something was going to happen in the Pacific, and we knew that there was going to be an attack. And certainly the Navy's intelligence apparatus at the time was very disorganized. We didn't have any intelligence for the most part. We didn't have a CIA, we didn't have an NSA, we didn't have Director of National Intelligence. So we had very little in the way of intelligence gathering. And so certainly it could be argued that we should have figured out that if there was something going to happen in the Pacific, if Japan was going to attack somewhere, it might be where we had almost our entire Pacific fleet moored and anchored, because we didn't have any torpedo nets or barrage balloons or really anything protecting the fleet.
Mm-hmm. So the conspiracy theories, just to put that to rest.
Yeah, put that to rest.
Put that to rest completely.
Yeah.
Okay.
Disorganization, yes. Conspiracy theory, no.
Yeah. But, so nothing's changed. I shouldn't say that. In many cases, maybe some things haven't changed.
Well, we have 17 intelligence agencies.
Well, there you go. So after Pearl Harbor, the United States is in the war against Japan, and Germany declares war on the United States 3 days later.
Yep.
And we're monitoring both Japan, Germany, other countries as well.
Absolutely.
But those two are the main focus at that time. At that time, there had to be a lot of recruitment for code breakers. You had to bring, as you said, at one time, it was 10,000. But we know that most of the men at the time were joining the military. But was there any hesitation at all about bringing more women on board?
I don't think there was any hesitation, and I think that's really important, that the Allied countries were more willing to be inclusive and bring in women than the Axis countries were. So when I was doing my research in the National Archives in College Park, I actually found a naval memo. The Navy had been recruiting for years from MIT, from Yale, from the Ivy League, for its small code-breaking bureau, and they were generating memos, and they would recruit men before the war. That's what they, you know, preferred to do, educated men. And I literally found a memo where the month before Pearl Harbor, where some naval bureaucrat typed news source women's colleges. So the light bulb moment went on over somebody's head. If the educated men are going to be unavailable to us because they're fighting, because they're shipping out, let's see what these educated women can do. And meanwhile, William Friedman, as I said, for the Army, had been hiring women all along. And so there really was no hesitation about hiring women. They were not sure that women could keep a secret. And they were not sure, you know, how much women could do in the way of, you know, this really difficult work. But pretty quickly, as the women came in, and we broke more systems and we needed more people to exploit them, and the women proved that they could do the work, any remaining men who were doing it were shipped out, actually. So the big compounds in Washington became virtually all female.
All right, so let's talk about the big compounds in Washington. Mm-hmm. As was mentioned in the introduction, I did not realize that you lived only a mile from Arlington House.
Neither did I until I started reporting. Yeah.
I wondered whether that was part of the motivation for writing the book.
No.
That was just a coincidence.
No, it was a coincidence, yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
So talk about these installations that they eventually put up.
Yeah, so, you know, again, I live in the D.C. area now where we have 17 intelligence agencies, and if the CIA needs like an off-campus site for a secure conference, there's any number of facilities like that in Northern Virginia and Maryland, but there was nothing like that in World War II. And all of a sudden, both the Army and the Navy need large compounds for thousands of people doing the work that computers would do now in many cases. And they didn't have anything. They needed them. They needed facilities that were off the beaten path. They thought Washington might get bombed, but pretty accessible to Washington. So it turned out that a couple of girls' schools were provided the perfect site. And so this was back in the day of what was called junior colleges, back in the day when it was thought that that you didn't want women to get too educated, that too much education was bad for women. So Arlington Hall, before the war, had been a junior college where a young woman could board and get maybe a couple years of high school and then a couple years of kind of college, you know, some English, some French, some music, some deportment, some typing, some horseback riding, you know, that sort of thing. And so the Army kicked all the girls out, took over the facility and built huge temporary buildings and moved the school teachers in and turned it into a top secret intelligence gathering facility. And the Navy would ultimately need something similar. And so they took over a girls' school on Nebraska Avenue in D.C., where the Department of Homeland Security is headquartered now. And it kicked those, the Mount Vernon Seminary had been really a place where daughters of members of Congress were educated, a lot of Washington sort of muckety-mucks sent their daughters there. They kicked those girls out, and the girls had to take classes in Garfinkel's department store until they could find a new place to study. And the Navy took over that facility. There's a chapel there. If you ever drive on Nebraska Avenue from America University over to Connecticut, take a look on the right, and you can see it. You can still see the chapel where all the women were sat down and told that they would not to think that they wouldn't be shot just because they were female if they talked about their work. They all remember that.
Again, it's such a different time, and to think that, you know, this was unprecedented, that the United States had been attacked, and as you mentioned, there was, you know, some suspicions that, or the possibility that Washington could be bombed, mm-hmm. or that the United States could be attacked from the East Coast. Mm-hmm. So a lot of these women, so many women descending on Washington, the Washington area, they had to find a place to live. Mm-hmm. And that was a real challenge, wasn't it?
Absolutely. And the other thing about Arlington, where I live, we still have, a lot of them have been renovated now, but we have a lot of 2- and 3-story garden apartment buildings, just brick apartment buildings. And what I had also never realized is that most of them were built to house these women because of this influx of women during the war. So they were boarding in people's homes. I mean, it was like an early version of Airbnb, right? If you had a basement or you had an attic or you had a spare bedroom, you would be asked to put up these women. Eleanor Roosevelt had a big, really dorm built called Arlington Farms on property now where Arlington Cemetery is. There were women living in group houses. There were a couple of Navy women living above the Key Bookstore. I don't know if people remember that in D.C. And they had some deal where they could use the telephone. No, they could borrow books if the bookstore staff could use their bathroom. And I mean, really, they were scrambling for housing anywhere they could find it.
You mentioned Dorothy Dot Brayton from Lynchburg, Virginia. She's probably the one person in the book that you follow the most. And she was a superstar. She was a superstar, but there were others. First of all, let's start with Dot Braden. Why did you follow Dot?
Well, I followed Dot for a bunch of reasons. She's alive, so I could interview her. Well, I mean, I say that because a number of the women I write about, I relied on oral histories that they had left, because these are women. Dot's 98. She was 94 when I started my reporting, and I didn't always have the advantage of the woman still being alive. So with some of the other characters, I had to rely on oral histories or memorabilias or memoirs that they might have written. But with Dot, she's a good raconteur. She had a good memory of her traveling to Washington and of the work that she did and the friendships that she formed. Although she did not realize how important the code-breaking effort she was part of was. She did not fully apprehend the importance of her work. And she has a good sense of humor. I was able to get her full personnel record, so I was able to read her background check that was done at professors at Randolph-Macon Women's College, as well as the superintendent of the school systems where she worked. So I had a lot of supplementary information on her that could supplement her recollections, and that was important to substantiate. These women were remembering things from 70 and 75 years ago. And also, she's very representative of particularly of the Army's operation. A young school teacher, 23 years old, plucky, patriotic, no experience in code breaking. And she came to Washington, and within a month, she was literally sinking ships.
And none of the women had an idea what they were doing when they went to Washington, right?
No. Of the ones who had been recruited at their universities by the Navy and had spent their senior year taking the correspondence course, they at least knew that they were training to become code breakers. When Dot walked through the doors of the Virginia Hotel, the Army at that point was recruiting in public. And so they couldn't even tell her what she was signing up to do for the War Department. So, yeah, she came to Washington without an inkling of what she would be doing. And the first thing she had to do was sign a loyalty oath and then a secrecy oath, agreeing that whatever it was, she would be shot if she told people what it was.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Welcome back to Smart Talk. Author Liza Mundy is on today's program discussing her latest book, Code Girls, The Untold Story of the American Women Codebreakers of World War II. This is from Liza Mundy's recent appearance at Midtown Scholar Bookstore in Harrisburg. Now, you've talked about the Army and the Navy several times. But when they first came, the women first came to Washington, there were no women in the military at that time.
Right.
So how did that come about?
Yes, and the Army women, like Dot, would remain civilians. The Army preferred to have its code-breaking force civilian, and that was an interesting choice. It meant that some really gifted women who were just 22 or 23 could be promoted to become the head of a unit. And that really did happen. So that worked well. But the Navy wanted its women to be in uniform, to be subjected to military hierarchy. So people may remember that the WAVES, Women Accepted for Volunteer Emergency Service, that was created during World War II, was a tipping point for women in the military. And the Navy didn't necessarily want the women to be fully part of the Navy. And there were a lot of battles to make sure that this wasn't just an auxiliary, to make sure that the women would be permitted to wear navy blue. At first, the Navy didn't want their uniforms to be navy blue like the men's. And there were really battles about these details. But once the women recruited from the universities then became naval officers. They learned how to shoot pistols. They learned how to command. There was a lot of conversation about women's leadership and proving that women could lead. And so when they entered that naval compound, they did so in naval uniforms.
And those uniforms were important.
They were beautiful.
In the Navy's eyes, they actually used them to recruit.
Yeah, and it worked. And you know, the Army created the WACS, which is also very important. They had some WACS in the Army code-breaking facility, but not as many. But the Navy women considered themselves superior because their uniforms were better looking. And also there was a rumor that the WAC uniforms were khaki, and there was a rumor that you also had to wear khaki underwear. And the Navy women were proud that they could wear their own underwear. women.
So what did these uniforms look like?
Oh, they were beautiful. They were designed by, I think the pronunciation is Mainbacher, if I'm correct, a French French and English designer. And they were really carefully designed, a beautiful six-panel gourd skirt, and very, very form-fitting and flattering. The women were very proud of their uniforms.
So as we mentioned earlier, Japan and Germany were the main focuses. This probably is a little bit easier to explain on paper in the book, but the codes and how they broke the codes. I mean, there were so many ways, but maybe let's start off by talking about some of the codes that Japan and Germany were sending. Because I mean, I have to admit that just reading over it, where you had maybe 20 or 25 numbers and how they broke these codes is so fascinating. Yeah. And you know why they needed very intelligent people to do it. But what kind of codes were Japan and Germany using maybe at the beginning of the war?
And just again, to give people a sense of how important these coded messages were, you think about how we send texts and tweets and emails and Facebook updates and Instagram updates all the time, every day, through the airwaves. And a lot of it is encrypted. Like, we hope that Amazon's encrypting it. We hope that our banks are encrypting this information that's being sent through the air. And it was the same during the war, only it was sent by radio. So generally by Morse code through the airwaves and public airwaves. So you can intercept from the public airwaves the enemy's messages and bring them to your compound and try to break them. And every diplomat, every military commander, Admiral Dönitz, who's commanding every single German U-boat, micromanaging the movement of his U-boats, they're all sending these messages. And everybody wants an unbreakable code system. So everyone is different and gets changed. So the Germans, if you've seen The Imitation Game, you might know that the Germans were using a machine called the Enigma machine. It was a handy little battery-powered machine. It didn't have to be plugged in. And it would scramble the letters of a German message. And every day or 2 days, the rotors would be moved around. There would be, the machine would be set in different ways to scramble it in a different way. And we had to unscramble that by really developing early computer menus that were, and it was ultimately American women who were doing that. So, and that's just the German system. So that's scrambling letters. And the Japanese had a completely different, sort of more old-fashioned but equally difficult system. They were using these giant code books and cipher books. And so a word like Maru for supply ship would be rendered as a 4 or 5-digit code group, like 6281. And then another set of numbers would be added to it from the cipher book. And that was an early version of encryption. They called it enciphering. And that number would be sent through the airwaves. And then Dot and her colleagues would have to strip out the encryptions. It'd strip out the number that had been added using something called non-carrying addition. So they had to use non-carrying subtraction and to strip it out to get down to the code group itself. And then they had to figure out what the code group stood for.
Now, you can hear how complicated that is. And, you know, as I'm reading the book, there are a lot of German Americans here. And we have a lot more Americans who probably could speak German than Japanese.
Right.
That had to be a challenge, too.
Very much so. And so the women from the universities who knew German, they were snatched up in order to translate the Enigma messages. Because to a certain point, a machine could unscramble it if you had set the settings right. So again, a certain part of it was math and early computer menus. But once the message came out, was restored to its original form and came out in German, then you needed people who understood German who could actually translate the message. And so there were women from Wellesley and Smith and Radcliffe who had been recruited by the Navy who were translating those messages. And it was even harder to find a Japanese speaker. American military men were trained. The Army set up a couple of Japanese language institutes. Sumner Rebstone was actually one of the translators. And but also they recruited missionaries. So people who had graduated from Bible colleges in the South. There was Bethany College in West Virginia, turned out a lot of missionaries who had spent time in Asia, and they were likely to know Japanese as well. So it was actually a woman named Virginia Adderholt who had been recruited from Bethany College who understood Japanese, who read the Japanese surrender message before anybody else.
And we're skipping over a lot here because, as you said, these codes changed all the time, like constantly. And it was like a crossword puzzle, much, much more difficult, right?
Yeah. Yeah, because crossword puzzles are designed to be solved. I mean, it may not feel that way when you're trying to, but, you know, the little clues and incentives are built in to sort of keep you going. And a code system is the exact opposite. Everybody wants to develop an unbreakable system. That's, you know, the hope is that you will never solve it. So it is like when they would recruit the women, they certainly wanted people who enjoyed puzzles. But it was also very important to be able to tolerate frustration and failure. And that was very stressful. I mean, many of the top code breakers really had ultimately had mental breakdowns.
Yeah, you talked about that I mean, throughout the book, many of the women code breakers, they had mixed feelings about it because a lot of them were having good times.
Yeah.
They were, you know, they developed friendships. They were able to go out and socialize, even though they couldn't tell anyone, what they were doing. But they had mixed feelings because a lot of them were having good times, but at the same time, they knew what they were doing, that people's lives depended on it. American lives, they wanted to save, but actually some of the codes they were breaking would lead to the deaths of other people.
Sure. It was a very complicated work that they were doing. So they knew that their brothers and their boyfriends were crossing the Atlantic or were out there on aircraft carriers and destroyers in the Pacific. I mean, they knew that acutely. And some of them were able to track the progress of their brothers' ships. One of the women that I interviewed was actually the watch officer in the Navy office that when they got a message saying that her own brother's ship was about to be hit by a kamikaze. So that's, you know, that's the enormity of the kind of work that they were doing. And they remembered also, particularly the beginning of the war, when the wolf packs were out there in the Atlantic, the German wolf packs, the submarines, the U-boats, when an American ship would be lost, it was just a terrible, just the effect on the country's morale. I mean, it was a disaster, obviously. And they remembered that their commanding officers would come down and yell at them. They just felt terrible responsibility. Anytime a convoy went down or anytime a ship went down or they were unable to get the key, for that couple of days for the Enigma messages, if the menu didn't give them the setting that they needed, they just felt enormous responsibility for these lives. And I think it's hard for us to sort of maybe understand now is that women were made to feel very responsible for the morale of the troops. I mean, they were supposed to be writing letters to the boys, you know, and bring the boys home and keep morale for the troops. So these women felt enormous responsibilities for the lives of the men.
And almost all the women that you profiled in the book or talked about in the book were writing to servicemen.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, they were. I mean, not just their brothers and their friends, but they were keeping up morale. So Dot, for example, my central character, was writing six men simultaneously, and she was actually somewhat more reluctant to have that end up in the book than the truth of her code-breaking service. But I assured her that it was really actually quite normal, and it was. Some women were writing as many as a dozen. Dot would eventually marry one of the men that she was writing, and some of the women would end up marrying men who they had been writing during the war, who they had never even met in person until the end of the war.
Now, Dot's husband, I'm jumping ahead a lot here, but Dot's husband, how many times did she see or meet him in person?
You know, I asked her about this so many times because it just was hard for me to process. So at the beginning of, one of the reasons Dot signed up to come to Washington and break codes was because she had a college boyfriend who was pressuring her to get married, and he had sent her a diamond ring from his training camp. And she liked him, but she didn't want to marry him. She didn't want to follow him to training camp. She was looking for an out. And so coming to Washington to do war work was an out. And then she started writing. There were other men who she knew. And again, you're just encouraged to write any guy and keep his morale up. So she started writing another man, she had known him from Richmond, Jim Bruce, and he had sort of been courting her, but he was also courting a couple other women, she learned, and so she had saved their correspondence, and I was really able to track the progress of their relationship through his letters back to her, and her letters were so important to him. But what's interesting is that from the time he left and the time 2 years later when he came back, they did get engaged. They got engaged through their correspondence. And I kept saying to her, wait, he never came back, right? You never went there. You all didn't see each other during this period, but you got engaged. And she kept saying, yeah, yeah. You know, because that was just, it was the norm.
Yeah. Can't imagine that today. Yeah. Can't imagine the men writing several women, but, you know, that's that's a different book. You mentioned the Battle of the Midway. At the time, late 1941, early 1942, the United States was crippled. I mean, the fleet in the Pacific fleet at Pearl Harbor had been heavily damaged.
Right.
Japan's goal was to cripple it completely, take it out of the war. That didn't happen. But Midway was a turning point, and these code breakers had just such an important role in that.
Code breaking was everything in the Battle of Midway, because just as you say, you know, we had been crippled at Pearl Harbor, but our aircraft carriers were out of the harbor, so we weren't destroyed at Pearl Harbor, and they were able to rehabilitate some of the ships that were damaged. So we didn't lose certainly all of our ships by any means, but the Japanese wanted to finish us off, and that way they could get maybe a negotiated peace in the Pacific and be allowed to keep their holdings, and so that was the point of Midway. And so in June of 1942, the Japanese sent a major fleet that was going to finish us off at Midway. But there was also a deception program. They were also sending a smaller fleet up to the Aleutian Islands. And the hope was that we would follow them up to the Aleutians, send most of our remaining ships up there, and they could be waiting for us at Midway. And instead, we broke the messages. We learned that this Japanese had set out to were going to ambush us and destroy us. And so instead, we lay in wait at Midway, not going up to the Aleutians. Or I think we just sent maybe a few ships up there. But we were lying in wait for the Japanese, and it was a 3-day battle. And the outcome was very, very different from Pearl Harbor and very different from what the Japanese had anticipated.
If I remember correctly, four Japanese aircraft carriers were sunk at Midway.
Right.
So they were crippled in a lot of ways. But the code itself, I mean, one of the real things I enjoyed in the book is when someone like Dot or a lot of other superstar code breakers you mentioned in the book, when they would discover that they have broken a code and they had that kind of information, what the Japanese were planning, this deception to the Aleutian Islands in Alaska, that everyone would just be thrilled. So, I mean, that was just so important. That could have been that was a turning point for the war.
Yeah, and I should also say that Midway was even better than that, in that we knew that the code breaking is an even better story, that we knew that they were headed to a geographical location that they had designated AF. But we didn't know what AF stood for. And Joe Rochefort, who had been trained by Agnes Driscoll out in the Pacific, they thought it was Midway. But they couldn't convince Washington that it was Midway. And so they designed this ruse in which we sent a message in the clear, as we called it, not a coded message in English, saying Midway is low on water, that they're low on water at Midway. And because knowing that the Japanese would pick that up, and they did. And the Japanese then radioed back, oh, they're low on water at Midway, and sure enough, they said AF. And so that was how Joe Rochefort and the naval officers in the Pacific proved to Washington that it was Midway that the Japanese were headed for. And so it was a group of really smart male codebreakers who did that, and there would ultimately be a lot of bureaucratic infighting and people trying to take credit for that. All those men were very generous in their memoirs in pointing out that they had all been trained by Agnes Driscoll. And so her hand was also part of that.
Another significant intercepted code led to the death of Japanese Admiral Yamamoto. Now, Yamamoto was the architect of Pearl Harbor. So you don't hear very often about someone that high rank or a commander, someone that high up in the military or in government who was actually killed. But that led, a code led to where he was going to be, and his plane was shot down.
Yeah, and that's one of my favorite anecdotes in the book. So there was a group of women from Wellesley, and they were assigned to something called the Inter-Island Cipher. And if you think about the choices you make when you're sending messages, if it's a long message, you might send it by email. And if it's a short message to somebody, you might send it by text. And so the Inter-Island Cipher was something that the Navy set up basically sort of to text back and forth between ships or islands. And so the Wellesley women were set to work that cipher system, and it had a key that changed every month. So every month they had to work really hard for a couple of days to break back into the cipher system. And so just to give you a sense of the good times they would have in their off hours, there was a lot of alcohol in Washington to relieve the stress. And a lot of these women were living in group homes for the first time, and the naval officers were able to live out of the barracks, and so the Wellesley women were. And they would have these big blowout parties. And their commanding officer remembered with admiration that they would come to him and say, well, when can we have our next party? And he would look at the wall map to see when the key was going to change. And he would say, well, you can have your next big blowout on such and such a day, because that'll give you 2 weeks to recover from your hangovers before you have to break back into the key system. But what happened in April 43 is that a bunch of messages started coming down about Yamamoto's upcoming inspection tour. And some of the messages were traveling in the main Japanese naval fleet code that was being worked mostly on the spot by men in the Pacific, but they were also sending supplementary information in the Inter-Island Cipher that the Wellesley women were reading. And so they worked closely together, the Wellesley women and the men out in the Pacific, to exactly assemble his itinerary, when he was going to be in the air, when he was going to land in the Solomon Islands, when he was going to be on a minesweeper, back in the base, back up in the air. And they got it so precisely right that we were able to shoot his plane out of the air. And of course, we couldn't have the American public knowing that that was a result of code breaking. We couldn't have the Japanese knowing. But in the compound, they knew. And they remembered cheering going up in the naval code breaking compound when they knew that the plane had been shut down.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Coming up on tomorrow's Smart Talk, Jess King, the Democrat running against Congressman Lloyd Smucker in the 11th Congressional District, joins us. That district includes all of Lancaster County and the southern part of York County. We're listening to best-selling author Liza Mundy talking about the hero codebreakers in World War II and discussing her book, Code Girls, the untold story of the American women codebreakers of World War II. This is from Ms. Mundy's appearance at Midtown Scholar Bookstore in Harrisburg.
Codebreaking became so important. Just think about supplying the military. The Japanese, food, supplies, spare parts, codebreaking went a long way toward keeping the Japanese military, the army in particular, from getting what they needed.
Exactly right. And that's where Dot comes in, and the other civilian school teachers. So, and this is the part that Dot still has trouble getting her mind around. That there were three code-breaking operations in World War II that were the most important. And one was the breaking of the German Enigma cipher. The other was the Battle of Midway. But the other was the relentless breaking of the codes being used by the ships that were supplying the Japanese army. So the Japanese Navy's out there in the Pacific, and we're having the Battle of Midway and stuff, but the army, the Japanese army, has spread out on all these islands. They've taken Guam, they've taken the Philippines, they've taken all of these peninsulas and land masses, and they have to hold them now, and they have to be supplied. And they're being supplied by commercial ships called Marus that have been commandeered by the Japanese army. And it is school teachers like Dot who are relentlessly breaking those messages as fast as they can. They say where the ship is coming from, where it's headed, what it's carrying. And often there was something called a noon position message that said where it would be at noon the next day, which is what better piece of intelligence for an American submarine commander. Dot remembers running. She remembers running to the next station to take the message, to get it along in the chain so they could get the messages broken as soon as possible and get the intelligence out to the submarine commander. And as a result of that, we sunk thousands and thousands and thousands thousands of supply ships so that the Japanese army wasn't supplied, so that most of the deaths out there in the Pacific were the result of starvation and disease, Japanese army deaths.
That's something that you don't hear a whole lot about, but so many deaths, thousands of Japanese dying from starvation. Think about that. That they couldn't even live off the land.
And they would break messages. They would break messages in which they would see the results of their effort. The messages would say things like, you know, we're chewing our rice raw instead of boiling it because it lasts a little bit longer when you do it that way. So they were seeing messages that told the effect that their work was having.
You mentioned that very early on, even before the war, that the code breakers were trying to break codes from diplomats.
Yep.
There was a Japanese diplomat, and I have to admit, this was something that I was not aware of, that you don't read about a whole lot in history books, that Japan had an ambassador to Germany. You know, we knew they were part of Japan, Germany, Italy, part of the Axis, but you really don't hear a whole lot about how they communicated. But Japan had an ambassador to Germany who just was, he was in love with Germany, Hitler, and the guy provided so much information because he would send codes back to Japan, back to Tokyo, from Germany. Talk about Ambassador Hiroshi Oshima.
So again, I mentioned we had a small code-breaking unit the Army did before the war, and thanks to a woman named Genevieve Grochin, who was had a master's in math from University of Buffalo. She wanted to be a college professor. She couldn't get a college to hire a woman to teach math before the war, so she was recruited in even before the war. And she had the central insight that allowed us to break that diplomatic communication system. So there are all these Japanese diplomats stationed in Europe, in occupied countries, in Axis countries, and then Oshima's buddy-buddy with Hitler, just as you said, you know, admires him so much. And there, and the diplomats are sending these very wordy messages back to Tokyo, to the central office in Tokyo, saying that everything they're hearing in Europe, everything they're learning on the street, everything they're learning from Hitler and Mussolini. And one of the most important messages was when the Japanese diplomats were invited to tour the coast of France. Hitler was very proud of his Atlantic Wall, the fortifications along the French coast. So they went and were wined and dined and admired the fortifications and dutifully reported back to Tokyo on where the coast was well fortified and where it wasn't so well fortified. So when we were planning the D-Day landings, that was incredibly important intelligence to have, that Normandy would be a better place to land than Calais.
What about on the other side? You don't write a whole lot about that. I mean, obviously, the Japanese, the Germans had code breakers trying to do the same thing with the Allies. How successful were they?
So the Germans certainly had success in breaking our convoy codes for a while. And I mean, that's interesting because we were working with the British, but at first the British didn't really trust us to keep a secret. They didn't tell us at first that they had broken the Enigma cipher. But as the war went on, we worked very closely with the British, and we had a special cipher for the convoys that we were sending, and the Germans broke that for a while, and it took us, the Americans had to convince the British that it had been broken. The British were somewhat unwilling to admit that that cipher was vulnerable. So, you know, these were, as a maker of codes and ciphers, you have to be somewhat humble. You know, like, yeah, they could break us, and we need to be on guard for that. And one of the things that William Friedman gets credit for is being willing to admit that we could be broken. So they were trying to, but, and I'm not a military historian, but what I'm told is the belligerent countries like Germany and Japan were more focused on belligerence and aggression than on intelligence gathering. So I think we were more assiduous in our efforts to break code systems.
I want to take a step backwards in just the last few minutes that we have, because this was important. The German U-boats wreaked havoc on shipping in the North Atlantic. For example, November 1943, they sank 43 ships and damaged 22 others. December 43, sank 32 ships, damaged 16 others. The U-boats were, as I used the word havoc, it really was dangerous for Allied ships, not just military ships, but merchant ships as well, to be traveling that area. And really, you got the sense that if Germany could win the war, that would be one of the ways that they would do it.
Yep.
But code breakers broke those U-boat codes.
Right.
And that was one of the keys to winning the war.
Absolutely. I mean, Churchill said that the Battle of the Atlantic, that whoever wins the Battle of the Atlantic, which was the U-boat war, you know, is going to win the war. It was enormously important. And at our, the beginning of our, just what you said about the supply ships, when we entered World War II, Donitz, the U-boats called this their happy time because we hadn't learned how to protect our merchant ships going up and down the Atlantic seaboard. And so there was just massive carnage as the U-boats picked off our supply ships. And you could see it happening from shore. The Outer Banks of North Carolina were called Torpedo Junction because of all the ships that got sunk, and people on the shore could see it. It was a terrifying time. And the Atlantic Ocean was cleared of the U-boats so that we could send the massive convoys over necessary for the D-Day landings. I mean, that was a huge effort just to get everything over there that we needed, and we couldn't have done it if we hadn't have cleared the U-boats out of the Atlantic.
What do you think the legacy of these codebreakers, the women, is?
Well, certainly a legacy of women in the military. They were the Navy women were veterans. They got GI benefits. Some of them are buried in Arlington Cemetery. It was a tipping point for women in the military. But just as you say, it's important to remember that a lot of our STEM work was pioneered during World War II. Our early computers were developed to calculate weapons trajectories. And it was often women who were doing that work. Grace Hopper for the Navy, who you might have heard of. Her name is now on a residential college at Yale, finally. There was a group of women who were programming the Army's ENIAC computer. And a lot of this code-breaking work was early computer work. And so we still have these battles over women and technology because the women got, you know, sent home after the war. And so we're still having these absurd arguments. Do women belong in tech? Why aren't there more women in tech? Maybe it's just not a field that women belong in, when in fact women were pioneering this work during the war. And we need to retrieve those stories.
Liza Mundy, thank you very much for
being
with us.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.